ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Matthew Ho, and we're here to talk about, well, who else do we talk about all the time? Trump, because he doesn't. Right. it's a new day, and it's a new dozen tweets or Truth Social posts and changes in policy.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know. Leave some comments and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Something feels off. Same news, same noise, different day.
Maybe you're just in the wrong place, mate.
Wait, what?
Maybe you've been here before.
I was what? I am a Cossack.
Wait, I remember this. I was a merchant.
Okay, this is getting weird. I was a Russian musician.
Okay, this is NOT what I expected.
Yeah, happens to everyone.
We just moved. Moscow Connect helped with everything.
Visa, paperwork, life is sorted.
Wait, it's actually that simple?
Maybe it's not about escaping.
Maybe it's about finding where you actually belong.
And let me ask you this. Now that Massey has lost his re-election, in the Republican Party in Congress, outside of Rand Paul, yeah. Is there anyone who's not owned by the Israelis?
That's tough. That's tough to see, because even those Republicans who were coming out for Massey, like Lauren Boebert, who went and campaigned for Massey, and or others who were with Massey on, say, like the Epstein files, like Nancy mm-hmm. Mace. When it comes to Israel, they are lockstep. They're getting their AIPAC checks, right? And they're going on television, and they're ironclad support for Israel. So, no, I'm not really certain. I don't believe there is anyone in the Republican Party who is against it. And even those who are usually who might be more on the side of America First or more budget hawks are still very amenable to an Israel First policy, subsidizing the Israeli military, right? Providing loan guarantees for the Israelis so that, that nothing, you know, the Israeli, I mean, people want to understand why the Israelis are so confident. It's because the Americans have a loan guarantee. You know, why are Israeli bonds still sold and purchased at high rates? It's because it's backed by the American government. You know, I mean, like that's the United, by law, the United States backs Israeli bonds. Israeli debt is backed by the Americans. And so the Israelis have this correct understanding that they will always have this lifeline from the U.S. And they've said that themselves. They understand it. It's just not a rainy day. It's just not in sense of some type of unforeseen issue. Originally, a loan guarantee was came in the 80s to Israel from the United States to help settle Russian Jews in Israel. But that has since taken on a life of its own. That certainly for a couple decades hasn't been an issue. They don't need that help anymore, but the loan guarantee remains. And they understand that this is their ability to do whatever they want, because the Americans will always back them, as well as too. If the American Congress, like we just had, in the House, a discharge petition, which people aren't familiar with, a discharge petition. That's when in the House of Representatives, so the American lower house, the Speaker of the House, who's Mike Johnson, he controls what comes to the floor, what gets voted on. Right. And so he can keep things out that he doesn't like, unless a majority in the House signs what's called a discharge petition, and then that bill comes up to be voted on. And that just happened with Ukraine funding. And, you know, I don't think they have the numbers to defeat a Trump veto. And I think this will pass in the Senate, but again, I don't think they have veto-proof numbers. But, you know, if the Americans are still at this point willing to give money to Ukraine, including, you know, as happened in the Biden administration, tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars to keep their government functioning, right? To pay pensioners, right? I mean, then why wouldn't the American government do that for Israel if that was the case? If the Israelis needed, we just did a $20 billion currency swap with the Argentinians,
true, right?
I mean, we wouldn't do that with Israel. And how much would it even require? It's a country of 9 million people. You know, I mean, so yeah, that long answer to your question, but no, Massey is gone, and that's the last of any, with the exception of Paul, in some ways, any sense in the Republican Party in Congress.
So basically, we could just ask the Republican Party to go ahead and register as a foreign agent.
At this point, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Democrats aren't much better. I mean,
they're about 80-90%, while the Republicans are about 100.
Right, right. I do think, Stas, I do think that in 2032, 2036, you could have an anti-Zionist Democratic presidential candidate. Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have to die. Hakeem Jeffries has to go his way. But I think by maybe 32 or 36, Israel-Palestine has become like abortion or gun control or things like that in the U.S., just a dividing social issue.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so I think that's possible, but that won't happen for a number of years in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's it's insane. I mean, think about it. Well, look, there's a reason America can't have new schools, because Israel needs to needs to rebuild its schools. I mean, you know, America's free medicine is going to have to suffer for a while. You know, the wanted American free medical system.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We pay the most and we get the worst outcomes. Yeah, it's great.
Meanwhile,
yeah,
Israel has an actual free medical system.
They do. Yeah, and it's probably, and I bet it's probably really good too. I bet like it's probably got some of the best outcomes in the world. And yeah, it's true here in the U.S. If that question is brought up, why can't we have better roads and bridges? Why can't we have a healthcare system like everybody else does? Right? Why can't we have broadband internet everywhere? Why do we still have lead pipes in a lot of our communities? Right? The answer comes back: we don't have enough money for that. And now they're going to essentially add $500 billion to the defense budget. Right? So it's going to be $1.5 trillion. As we're staring at a bond crisis, they're talking about how adding $500 billion, giving the Pentagon $500 billion more, is fiscally responsible. I mean, just the lunacy here, the insipidness, just the freakish clown show that Washington D.C. is. You know, this is the type of stuff that, you know, Gibbon would have written about in the history of the decline of the Roman Empire, right? I mean, it's this type of stuff. Like, really, you're going to continue to funnel this money into this Pentagon that can't win wars, that can't pass an audit, and whole purpose is basically as a pass-through for corporations to make profits? As, again, we're facing a, you know, we have this debt crisis. There is a, we have a bond. We are looking right in the face of quite possibly the worst bond crisis in the history of modern America. The conversation is not about, will the economic downturn in the U.S. be as bad as 2008? The question, the conversation now is, how much worse will it be than 2008? I mean,
will it
so
be as bad as 1929.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's you're seeing it here, Stas, in the sense of just how high our interest rates have gotten. And where our credit card rates are already at historic highs, with Americans carrying historic rates of credit card debt, something like the average credit card payment is like over $2,000 a month or something like that in the U.S. It's crazy. Auto loans are at the highest level of delinquency they've ever been. And the same thing, too, like I don't know for new cars, but for used cars, the rate is about 8.5% for a used car in the U.S. Wow. Mortgage rates, I think, just hit 6.75 the other day.
Well, I mean, like, low. I mean, historically speaking,
yeah, I mean, historically, say you go back to the end of the 70s, 80s, you know, even later 80s. Yeah, you had pretty high mortgage rates. But when you couple that with auto loans, with credit card bills, with just inflation in general, the lack of savings by Americans, the fact that 60-65% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, right? And then the inflationary pressures that haven't arrived yet because of this war, right? Oil inventories are still there. We still have a cushion on oil. We haven't gone 42-43% of our power plants are natural gas, but it's not the winter time, so we're not really feeling that yet, you know. And then all the byproducts, the secondary products of oil and gas, as well as just stuff the Gulf makes that maybe you didn't know about this 3 months ago. Like I didn't know like some crazy percentage of aluminum and copper come from the Persian Gulf. Now I do. Yeah.
It's a cheap electricity.
The cheap electricity. Exactly. Yeah.
Aluminum
is
all electricity. I'm getting aluminum.
But even too, even copper. Iran provides about 10% of the world's copper or something like that.
Yeah, copper's actually not. There's only a few places that actually provide a lot of copper, a lot of copper mines. That's
right. And it's so.
Cyprus up historically because Cyprus had a copper mines on it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so for the U.S., man, it's like if a third of our GDP growth is coming from investments in data centers and AI, what do you need for those data centers? You need copper.
Well, you need a lot.
You know, and if you know, you believe Donald Trump, the Arab Gulf states have promised trillions of dollars to invest in the U.S. That's all going into this AI data center bubble, essentially. I'm sure Trump's exaggerating. I don't think it's the $20 trillion he claims, but it is trillions of dollars that's involved here. And if the Gulf states collapse because their oil and gas infrastructure has been destroyed, let alone, or they just even doesn't get destroyed, things go back to normal, but there's essentially a 2-year recession, what's going to happen here in the U.S.?
Oh, Qatar isn't going back to normal. It's going to take it, I'd say, about 5 to 7 years to get back to normal.
That's what they say, yeah.
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 I looked at the damage. I mean, I used to do supply chain. I was director of supply chain or oil gas services and EPC.
Okay. I'm going to shut up then and let you.
I'm not going to do a lecture or anything. But I just know how long it takes to purchase a lot of this equipment in the middle of construction. And if it's destroyed as much as they're saying now it's destroyed, man, it's going to take forever. And it's not like they're the only, they're the only basket case. Everybody around them is our basket case. And they all are going to be bidding each other up. Because if you look at it, realistically speaking, there's only 4 major countries that can produce the stuff that needs to be produced in volume. Russia, China, U.S., and a smaller degree, India. And, Europe is out because they don't have the steel anymore. They don't have the gas, which is very gas intensive. So, yeah. Turkey, to some degree, can produce it, but not nearly as much. So, you're pretty limited in. Plus logistics and everything. So, yeah, that's not coming back anytime soon.
No, it's and then we the geopolitics of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're seeing this. The Pakistanis sent a squadron of JF-21s, right? So they're Chinese warplanes. They sent them to Saudi Arabia, supposedly, and a couple drone squadrons and air defense battery or whatever. And the Egyptians supposedly sent a squadron of their planes to the Emiratis. So you're seeing maybe a dividing line in the Gulf between these new alliances, an Emirati American Israeli bloc. Maybe the Egyptians are a part of that, but certainly this Pakistani, Saudi, Turkish, Qatari bloc, where the Kuwaitis and the Bahrainis are going to fall. I mean, Bahrain usually goes where Saudi Arabia goes, but Bahrain joined the Abraham Accords and Saudi Arabia never did. And it doesn't look like Saudi Arabia is joining those anytime soon.
Well,
so,
interestingly enough, Pakistan came out, and the Trump administration, very upset to find out, was providing air bases for Iranian airplanes to hide out while the U.S. was bombing.
Yeah.
So there's not small. I mean, when you're going to that step, you're obviously got pretty decent ties with Iran, even though they're different forms of Islam, but they've been at each other before. But I mean, when they're providing air bases, that's obviously something's in the works.
Just overall, I think the Pakistan has had ideas about being a world power for many years now. Their nuclear weapons certainly are a counter to India. But it's also this idea that they could provide a nuclear umbrella for Muslim countries, and they see that role for themselves.
Right.
Right. But then also, too, the way they have performed this role with Iran and the U.S. as a mediator, trying to mediate, Field Marshal Munir is back in Tehran today. He'll probably go. I imagine he would go someplace else afterwards. But yeah, no, they certainly have ideas of, and I think most states are understanding that when this thing is over, the Middle East is forever changed. And, you know, certainly the Emiratis are the clearest, where they are throwing their lot in with the Israelis and the Americans. And the Emiratis certainly have their own vision for how they fit in with their wars in Yemen and in Sudan, right? They're you know, how they see themselves in the order there, the structure there. And I got to imagine in Riyadh, the conversations are very intense about what they're going to do. Do we want to keep going with the Americans? Look at where it's gotten us. Yep. And I would say the same in Doha, right? And Kuwait City. The poor Iraqis are totally effed, right? Because the Americans hold their oil revenue. You know, if people who don't know, since our invasion and occupation, Iraqi fossil fuel revenue goes into the U.S. So every barrel of oil they sell. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's how the Americans have such a control over Iraq, is in 2003, when we invaded and occupied, seized everything. We set it up so that their revenue, so every barrel of oil, that money goes to the Fed in New York. And then the Americans provide that back to the Iraqis, either in cash or digitally, or, you know, whatever, some form of letter of credit or whatever. But yeah, that certainly is a way that the Americans have a gun to the head of the Iraqis. And, you know, Iraqi, their oil and gas provides, I think, 90% of the Iraqi budget.
Oh, yeah. I understand they have that control, but what's to keep them from going, okay, fine, we write off whatever money you have, you're not going to give it to us, we're just going to sell to China, or we're just going to sell through Iran to somebody else, and we'll just get money directly from the Chinese.
However the mechanism works, and it'd be great to have somebody on to explain that, because I've thought that too. Why don't they just tell the Americans to go pound sand and walk into the Ministry of Oil, right, and just essentially say, delete that, you know, delete the routing numbers and the account numbers,
right,
you know, kind of thing, and put these new ones in. I don't think it works that way. I don't think it's like that simple. Again, we should talk to someone who knows how to do it. But there's also a hesitation in Iraq, because there are those who favor the American presence there. I mean, there are those who think that the Americans are a stabilizing influence compared to Saudi Arabia, compared to Iran. There are those who what is his name? The Afghan premier who overthrew the king in the 70s, was it Dawood? Anyway, he used to say that he used to light his American cigarettes with Russian lighters.
Oh, yeah.
Right? This idea, right?
Playing both sides off, right.
Right, and you saw what happened to Afghanistan because of that, right? I mean, I think there's some of that. So I think the mechanism, the actual control, it's just not that easy to switch it, but there's also a desire to try and, as you said, play both sides off. But, you know, Iraq is in a really difficult place politically. The Americans vetoed for months who the prime minister was going to be. And, you know, as well as, too, you have the revelations that the Israelis had a base in Anbar. And that the Americans knew about it, and that the Israelis killed Iraqi soldiers as well as Iraqi civilians to protect that base. You had also, too, the Americans in that 5-week war, you know, that we're in a ceasefire now of, killed scores of Iraqi army, you know, bombing Iraqi resistance, Iraqi popular mobilization forces, which are a part of the Iraqi army and are actually co-located on Iraqi army bases. They killed scores of Iraqi soldiers. So you have an Iraqi population that is saying, what's going on? You know, how can this is humiliating. We can't allow this. And you have the memory of Islamic State, you know, and all that, you know, so, yeah.
But at the same time, the Iraqi military started firing at American planes. That fueler that got shot down, that said, well, it didn't get shot down. It collided with the other one and just fell out of the sky. or just fell out of the sky by itself. Whichever version you want to take. But for some reason, the other one that it collided with didn't have collision damage, but did have shrapnel damage on its tail section.
Yeah.
I found out about it about an hour through a couple sources, about an hour before it got posted. And they flat out said the original report was Eagle Eye 2 was what shot it down.
Okay.
And was fired more than likely by either the Iraqi army or the Iraqi militias because it was shot down over Iraq.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's too far of a reach. It was far well outside of Iran's reach. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah.
You just had those drone strikes. Those drone strikes this past week in Saudi Arabia and in UAE, including the one that hit the inside the perimeter of the nuclear power plant there. Those came from Iraq, right? I mean, if you look at the map, or UAE is a pretty long haul from Iraq.
It is
right.
It is.
I mean, but also too the Iraqi resistance. They were hitting Israel. Until the Americans got the Iraqi government to kind of clamp down on them. But also, too, now as we kind of look at what's been occurring over the last, few years, we see the Axis resistance plan here and the incredible strategic patience they had, incredible patience for, for Hezbollah to, once that ceasefire occurs in November of 24, to adhere to it, not because they want to respect the ceasefire out of some type of honor with the Israelis, because we know the Israelis killed hundreds of people during that ceasefire. But the reality is that this is the plan. You need to hold off. You need to wait. And eventually, when we need you to come in, you're going to have a much greater effect. And that's what's happened.
Have you been paying attention to that Gaza Armada that was coming in?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Israelis intercepted it over 1,000 kilometers outside of their national waters.
I think the bulk of this fleet was picked up about 250, but they were intercepting stuff. They've picked up past Cyprus by Greece. A couple months ago, they were out by Greece. They picked them up or detained them, kidnapped them. Piracy and kidnapping is what it is, And then now with the Ben-Gavir video, you can add in parading as well on the list of, violations of international law and war crimes.
Beatings, rape.
I know. Yeah. And, last year because there's been multiple fleets and now they're sending them out a couple times a year, a few times a year. It's really great that sustained pressure. Even though when you do it that often, you get a drop off in terms of how many people are paying attention.
Right.
But, last year, the Israeli drones hit a couple of their ships in Tunis, dropped some type of pyrotechnic, dropped some type of incendiary thing in Tunis. There's been sabotage on the ships in ports throughout Europe, stuff added into the fuel or whatever, things like that to try and, but no, it's absolutely, and the reports now coming out, what I read this morning was that the organizers are saying 428 were detained and at least a dozen are reporting sexual assault, at least a dozen. Well, and we all know with sexual assault, that's always it's always two or three times higher. This is the way it works. Yeah.
Right. And we know that the Israelis picked up that old Gestapo practice of using dogs for sexual assault. I actually had somebody ask me, well, how does that work? I'm like, I'm not gonna go into that. going into that comment. I'm gonna touch it with a mile long
point. I mean, and who knows what they actually did, but as somebody pointed, I can't remember who it was, pointed out, just the fact that you had a naked prisoner and a dog in the same space together, just that alone, regardless of anything else that's happening, that alone is horrific for the person involved. It is terrifying, and it is sexual abuse. Anytime you strip a person and subject them to something, there's a sexual abuse, inherent in what you're doing. And I'm not sure. Did the dogs penetrate? Did the dogs just hump them? Yes. Did the dogs and then the nonsense? Oh, it's impossible to teach a dog to do that.
Oh, bull.
I've had 14 dogs in my life, man. You can teach a dog to do whatever you want to do. They taught dogs to ride tricycles, for Christ's sake.
Rape in general is almost never about sexual gratification. It's always about control.
That's absolutely
the domination of the victim. So if they're doing this as a state policy, you know, it's about controlling and dominating, humiliating their enemies, the ones they can't flat on just kill, you know, or have commit suicide.
Right. And that's what the occupation, you know, when you're there, humiliation is what you hear from the Palestinians the most, right? That's what their complaint or their grievance is the most about the occupation, about the subjugation, the oppression, the apartheid. It's the humiliation. It's just the daily humiliation. And that is, yeah, absolutely. As you said, that's policy, you know, and you're not going to find it written down that the Israeli government has a policy of humiliation. You're certainly not going to find written down that they have a policy of sexual abuse and rape, or that they have a policy of using dogs to, but you see it in all their actions. And the way that when soldiers who are caught on tape raping a Palestinian prisoner, when, you know, the world finds out, and in order to try and cover their ass, the Israeli government says they're going to put these guys on trial, and the whole country has a meltdown.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And absolutely, you have members of the Knesset, you know, arguing about whether Israel has a right to rape Palestinian prisoners. You know, I mean, that's the policy right there. Every soldier, every prison guard knows, every settler knows that this is sanctioned. Not only sanctioned, they want you to do this because, as you said, the humiliation is part of the subjugation.
And you know, the chief rabbi of the IDF, he famously said that it's only rape if it's a non-Jewish war. No, it's only rape if it's a Jewish woman.
Yeah. You see, that's apartheid, right? Huh? Yeah.
What did you ask?
Oh, I know. I said that's apartheid, right? Oh, yeah. That's apartheid in a nutshell right there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, now the Israelis are talking about, they're demanding evacuation of Tyre. Tyre, which is about a 4,000, maybe 5,000-year-old city.
Right,
that way predates even the Hebrews arriving in the Promised Land, and now they've decided that's I guess they want to level portions of Tyre, if not the whole city.
Their ethnic cleansing campaign is clear. The whole policy is demolition. Right. I mean, the whole policy is demolition. That's what they're doing. They're just destroying house after house. The army can't even do it. They have to bring in civilian contractors, because they can't keep up with the pace. The army's engineers can't do it themselves, so they have to bring in civilians to do it. And that, of course, is being stymied by the Hezbollah drones, right? I mean, which is so, to me, so such an equalizer, right? And it's just one more example of 20th century versus 21st century, not just for the obvious, the technology involved and but it's the idea that you have adversaries now that have an equivalent degree of surveillance and precision strike that allowed the United States, its allies, its proxies for decades to dominate. Right. I mean, this was the 1970s revolution in military affairs, right? You know, and the Americans and their allies and proxies had it for decades and their adversaries didn't. And now guess what? Your adversaries have it. So whether it's the 20, you know, or however much a Shahed drone cost, 5,000 or 20,000 or whatever it is, destroying a $1 billion radar system, or the fact that the Israelis, you know, according to Israeli media from reports in the IDF is not operating in the daytime in southern Lebanon, right? I mean, they took away that freedom of movement, and there are no safe spaces for the Israelis. I mean, in Iraq and Afghanistan, if the Iraqi resistance and the Afghan Taliban had these type of FPV fiber optic drones, our occupation would not have been sustainable. Yep. We, even though the IEDs were difficult, they had effects, tactical, operational, strategic, political, all those things, right? They still never stopped our freedom of movement. We never had a day in Iraq where we can't operate during the day. Were there some localized areas that, okay, this is, you know, too bad to go into today, right? Or, yeah, sure. But were there parts of Afghanistan that we couldn't get into? Because combined with the terrain and the IEDs, it was a heck of a long fight to get in. I mean, I remember seeing route clearance teams in Zabul province take 18, 24 hours to go 20 kilometers, right? But, you know, same time too, our freedom of movement wasn't curtailed and our bases were always safe. We had indirect fire, but, you know, their mortars and rockets, it was limited volume. It wasn't very accurate and they were very susceptible to our counter battery. So, I mean, this is completely upending American warfare. The idea that we don't have that dominance, if we can see it, we can kill it. The enemy has that now too. That totally upends it. And so doctrinally, industrially, in terms of the culture, all of that is upended. And, you know, this reality of what the IDF is facing, that, and there are going to be people out there who are going to say, well, the IDF is going to build better nets or whatever, better cages and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They're going to come up with an optic that can see the drone and et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, they will. And then in 30 or 60 or 90 days, Hezbollah will counter that. And then in 30 or 60 or 90 days, the Israelis will counter the Hezbollah counter to the Israeli countermeasure. And then there'll be another countermeasure. And I mean that, but the idea that the battle space is now no longer dictated by the U.S. or Israel, that the adversaries have as much control of the entirety of the battle space as the Americans and the Israelis and their proxies and allies, that is a new generation of warfare, if you will, in the sense of what it really means. We were lucky we had this as our own for many, many years. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But like I said, if the Iraqi resistance or the Afghan Taliban had these things, forget it. We couldn't have waged those occupations.
But you know what amazed me with all that is starting with Gaza, the Israelis come in there as if drone warfare in 22, 23 hadn't existed. They get whacked. So those forces start to put on grills and things like that and change. Then they call up their reserves to go into Hezbollah, and it's all over again. No lessons learned. 4 years of drone warfare in Ukraine. You see how people move. See how they don't bunch up. Totally different designs and equipment, things like that. And it's as if none of that ever existed.
They're
supposed to be the smartest people around, and they act. But Hezbollah learned. Hezbollah learned quite well.
Yeah, and the Iranians certainly did. I mean, like the commentary coming out of Ukraine during the 5-week, you know, air campaign there, the war with Iran and the U.S., you know, this past couple months, you know, the commentary coming out of Ukraine was just, they're apoplectic. They couldn't believe it. Why didn't they pick up the phone and call us, kind of thing, you know, like, right? And then Zelensky made that big trip and they're selling all this stuff now and everything, you know, and he's, you know, but yeah, no, I mean, I think a lot of it's just the imperial hubris, right? That explains a lot of it. But there's an entitlement. We had the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a racism to this. Mm-hmm. Those people can't fight us, right? You know, as well as to just the belief that, all the issues that we had for Israel, say the issues we had 82 to 2000, then the 2006 war, we got our, you know, since we got our butts kicked and that was a failure, lost war. We've learned all the lessons. Our generals know. Right. This is what Americans said going into Afghanistan, escalating the war in Afghanistan in 2009. All the things that we learned in Iraq, we're going to use now in Afghanistan. And so victory is assured because General Petraeus and McChrystal and Allen and all them, they learned the lessons of Iraq, and now they're going to win in Afghanistan.
Yeah, that was exactly. That's worth laughing about. It's just amazing the lessons they don't learn. But, you know, the society, though, I watched a video today. It looks like a bar, and people are seated on stools. It's an outdoor area. And on a big screen, they're watching, civilians. They're watching one of the villages in Lebanon be demolished. Which reminds me of when they were bombing Gaza, and people go out there, have a picnic to watch the bomb, or even worse, the settlers would rent ships And they would just cruise up and down the coast of Gaza with their little children, tell them, look, this is the land we're clearing out. This is where we're going to build our house. And watching women and children being destroyed by, being murdered by Israeli bombs.
That's the culture, man. That's the society. In 2017, when I was in Palestine and went to a village called Belin, which the apartheid wall had basically separated the villagers from their fields, right? Deliberate, right? You know, that type of thing. And every Friday, the villagers protested. They walked up to the wall. They protested. They threw rocks at the wall. The Israelis shot back with gas, rubber bullets, that type of thing. And in, if you looked over to the right, there was a settlement there. And below the settlement was this big parking area. And literally like food trucks, like trailers to sell concessions. And people would come because every Friday the people in Belin is well known, Belin would protest against this wall that took away their fields, right? And the Israelis would come to watch this, you know, why, you know, and the same thing, but more so when I was back in Palestine in 2024 and we went down to the Gaza border. We couldn't get into Gaza, of course, but we went to a settlement called Sderot, and there's an observation deck. And if you go to TripAdvisor and you look up Sderot, S-D-E-R-O-T, for the people interested, this observation platform, just like you have like at a national park or on the at a beach or something like that, with the big metal binoculars that you drop a quarter in or whatever, that was there. It's for people to look into Gaza. It had been established about 12 years before or so. And, but while we were there and we were doing a vigil, you know, a school group showed up of Israeli school kids. And they came running up the hill and the boys were in the lead. And when the boys, they were 15, 16 years old maybe, when they got to the top of the observation deck and were able to look out and see Gaza, they started pumping their fists and high-fiving and giving the finger Gaza. And we were about probably this was the northeast part of the Gaza Strip was what we could see. The fence line was probably maybe a kilometer away, if that. And so to Beit Lahia, to Jabalia, what else? Beit, I mean, these are all, they're all gone. I mean, you couldn't see anything. You could see these huge clouds of dust and dirt from the Israeli, maybe they were their armored vehicles, but more like it was their earth moving equipment, just destroying everything. And yeah, these kids had come on a school trip from 2 hours away to come see the genocide. And it was not educational in any sense, Staz. It was not any form of like, there's no sobriety whatsoever, like teaching children the reality of war, the cost of war, none of that. This was a celebration. And yeah, I mean, it was absolutely revolting. And it shows how that supremacy and the idea of ethnic cleansing and genocide exists in all levels of Israeli society, right? And I think the video you were talking about, I saw something similar, probably the same thing. It was for a unit returning back from duty in Lebanon. And at like their return home ceremony or whatever, they were showing the successes of this unit. Yeah, and essentially the destruction, the wholesale destruction of Lebanese villages and towns. Just the opposite. I mean, just these war crimes. And as you were saying, people drinking a can of beer while watching it and cheering it on. Yeah.
It's horrible. And that's the point too. People don't seem to get. Sure. Maybe 50-60% of the population hates Netanyahu, but over 70% of the population supports what he's doing. They just want a more radical person in charge to support even more what he's doing.
Right. Well,
upscale the genocide.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen in the last month or so the ceasefire in Iran and the ceasefire, you know, which is a complete farce, ceasefire in quotes in Lebanon. You know, the Israelis have killed more than 3,000 people in Lebanon, over 500 of them women and children, killing entire families. They've killed over 100. Paramedics, EMTs, firefighters, deliberately, right? Those were all double tap strikes. Just saw a video of one today where civilians have been killed and wounded on a street. As soon as the ambulance, the Israelis killed them. As soon as the ambulance pulls up, it gets hit by, you know, a Hellfire missile or whatever the Israeli variant is. You know, I mean, so the you know, the most political stress Benjamin Netanyahu has endured, like the greatest political opposition he has faced, aside from his criminality and corruption, right? But in the last few years, the biggest political stress for him has been this, quote, ceasefire, unquote, that he signed on to in Lebanon,
yeah.
Right? And you've got Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett uniting, creating a new party, basically built around opposition to a ceasefire in Lebanon. And, you know, here in the U.S., people with a talking point, oh, it's not Israel, it's Netanyahu. It's not, you just need a, you need a guy like Yair Lapid or even Naftali Bennett. I'm sure he doesn't still, you know, celebrate murdering Palestinians like he has in the past. Him back or Benny Gantz or somebody like that.
Just
and
go Ben yeah. Gavira so we can get, everybody can right. get a birthday cake with a noose on it for a lynching.
I mean, right,
you know, it's pretty damn warped when your wife makes a birthday cake for you with a friggin' lynch noose on there. I mean, that's.
It's a sickness. It's
a
sickness.
It's an absolute sickness.
And it's throughout the entire society there. The Israelis who don't believe in that are in the minority. Those who have left the country, which, you know, there's no real good numbers on it. And I think those numbers get overstated quite a bit. But there has been essentially, I wouldn't call it a brain drain, although a lot of the Israelis who have left seem to be in the high tech industries who have the wherewithal to move to Philadelphia or Seattle because they have cousins there or whatever, and they can work from there.
Dual citizenship.
Dual citizens as well as, to, you know, but you know, it's a morality drain, yeah. You know? And so the ultra Orthodox are having 9-10 kids in their family. You know, even the conservative Israeli families are having 3, 4, 5, however many. The settlers have about a million kids each, I think. You know, I mean, so the opposition to this type of thing in Israel is minimal. And there's no one of any political significance in Israel who is countering any of this. And so you have, and it's why you see this mismatch between American Jews and Israelis on this. American Jews, except for the oldest American Jews, by and large are horrified by what they're seeing, and they're not, youngest American Jews are not supportive of Israel at all. You know, I mean, because, and I have a lot of Jewish friends, I have Jewish family, they're all horrified by this. You know, I mean, within Israel itself, it's a sickness in a society that is reinforced by their own mythology, by their biblical story, by their narratives. As I said, hey, we're going to take the kids, the school kids, to you know, look at the genocide, you know,
and celebrate it.
And celebrate it, yeah, yeah.
It's sick. So it is. It's such a prevalent social sickness. Did I mention? Or was it mentioned to Patrick? The Israelis, A, are now buying up land in South Cyprus and some of these villages, and they're closing them off to the Greeks. And B, yeah, go figure that one. I guess Cyprus is also promised. And B, they're now demanding from the Greek government that it rent to own Aegean islands to the Israelis.
I've seen that there's been a lot of movement from Israelis to Cyprus, I think that's all. It's been there for a while now. I mean, I've never been to Cyprus. I think I've heard it's very nice. Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, but yeah, that type of offshoring, if you will.
Yeah.
I need to wrap up. I got to get on something else, man. No problem. I appreciate it. Always good to talk to you.
Say hi to Mario. have fun. No, that.
Will do. Will do. I hope your foot is better.
Yeah, that's why I'm jerking around a little because it's pulsating. Old army. You know what old army injuries are.
Yeah.
Anybody that's served long enough, we all have them. It's just, you know, here, have some pills. Worry about it later if you live to later. And if you
yeah, and some later, of it, yeah, some of it you had it while you're in, and others it's like, oh, this is new. And then the doctor would be like, oh, no, this is, yeah, 20 years ago you were doing what? 25 years ago you were doing what?
Yeah,
no, that makes sense. No, that's about the timeline. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. Matt, thank you. Thank you very much for joining. We will continue the conversation.
Absolutely, man. You have a good one. Have a nice weekend.
You too. You too. Have fun on the next one. Cheers, everyone.